The Last Will and the Silencing of Barbara. The Last Will and the Silencing of Barbara Parrington. It was a still, bright August morning in Goole, East Yorkshire, the kind where even grief seems suspended in sunlight. But behind the hush of that summer air, in the quiet of a care home room, Barbara Parrington, mother, grandmother, sister, widow, and survivor, took her last breath. She was 92. It should have been the peaceful conclusion of a life etched in resilience. But it was not. Her passing set into motion a rupture, one that would unravel everything her family thought they understood about Barbara, her legacy, and the fragile trust that had once seemed unbreakable. Barbara had never asked for much. She had lived her life with quiet pride, bracing herself against the cold winds of loss and betrayal. Barbara was born on 17th of June 1926 in the modest village of Swinefleet. Her life's foundation was grit and quiet resilience. As a young woman, she met Ron during a Morecambe holiday. They married, moved to Kent, and in 1960 welcomed their only child, Sally Ann. But in 1968, Barbara returned from picking Sally up at school to find Ron gone, just a note as his farewell. Heartbroken but unbroken, Barbara moved to Worthing with Sally, took up administrative work, and rebuilt her world. The draw of home called her back to Yorkshire to be near her parents and beloved sister, Irene. There, she bought a dilapidated house at Nine Hook Road, Goole. Armed with DIY manuals and used tools, she and 11-year-old Sally restored it brick by resilient brick, transforming it into a monument of survival. In 1980, I drove up from our cramped bedsit in Norwood to meet the woman behind that home. Barbara greeted me with warmth. John, her companion, stationed at the door, reserved but kind, assigned us twin single beds, a polite, no-sharing rule in that Victorian abode. It was quaint, old-fashioned, and entirely Barbara. Mother and daughter's devotion was plain. Their love for interior design and bargain markets in Goole, Selby, and Beverly showed in remnants turned into curtains, fabric pattern throws, even a tissue box cover, sent to spruce up our flat. When our sons arrived, Ben in 1987, Remy in 1988, Josh in 1993, Barbara quietly stepped into grandmotherhood, cooking, cuddling, folding endless laundry. And pets, Bramble, our old English sheepdog born in 1986, became her delight. Soon, Barbara and John added three beef frisée, Emma, Rosie, and Lucy, to their menagerie. Their love was steady, emblematic, rooted in everyday rituals, not grand gestures. Then came 1992. Sally, our Sally, was diagnosed with an inoperable brainstem tumor. She was pregnant with Josh at the time. Doctors were blunt. The child wouldn't survive the surgery she needed. But Sally refused to choose between her life and his. She underwent the surgery. Against every odd, Josh was born, and he lived. Sally lived too, for a while. In 1994, I took her to New York for pioneering surgery. A team of specialists achieved what had seemed impossible. They eradicated the tumor. She was given a gift, the rarest kind, time. Time to mother, to laugh, to live. And for 4 years she did. But in 1998, fate returned. A cyst developed where the tumor had once been, a cruel complication from the surgeries that had once saved her. It was not the cancer that returned, but the consequence. In October that year, Sally died. She was 38. Barbara, once again, shouldered grief without complaint. After Sally's death in 1998, she stayed with us, helping to care for the boys, quietly holding us together in the wreckage of loss. She never asked how long she was needed. She simply remained until the silence grew less sharp, until we were steady enough to stand. Then she returned to Goole, to her own home, her own routine, and to John. Irene, Barbara's sister's story, was a tapestry of hardship and endurance. She married Bob, a shipyard man whose life was shattered by a brain injury at work. The insurance payout came, but it was hollow comfort. Irene became his full-time carer, giving everything she had to keep him afloat. Then came their daughter Jenny, a bright light, who married, had two sons in Norfolk, and then, cruelly, was claimed by breast cancer. Bob passed not long after, and when Irene finally found a second chance at happiness, fate slammed the door again. Bereft, Irene returned to Goole, her heart a patchwork of scars. Waiting there was John, steadfast as a lighthouse in a storm. He'd bought the house next door, 11 Hook Road, as an investment, but when Irene needed a refuge, he handed it to her rent-free. Quiet generosity. From that point on, the three of them, Barbara, Irene, and John, formed a bond forged in fire. Their lives became a rhythm of Sunday roasts, bingo nights, pub quizzes, and endless conversations over steaming mugs of tea. They weren't just neighbors. They weren't bound by blood, but by something far stronger, grief and grit, a family of choice. Even their wills told that story of loyalty. Irene named Barbara and John. John named Barbara. And Barbara's, at least the original draft, was ironclad. If Irene died first, which she did, everything flowed to Barbara. From there, Barbara and John had mirrored wills. Every last thing, the two homes, the savings, roughly £450,000, would pass to Sally's boys, the grandsons. It was sacred, unquestioned, until John died in early 2016. That loss blew Barbara's world apart. For decades, she and John had weathered the whispers, the side glances about their relationship. The 25-year age gap was a favorite target, gossip fueled most bitterly by John's younger brother, Stephen. He loathed Barbara, never accepted her, never softened. His contempt was always there, thinly veiled at best. Which is why what happened next felt almost sinister. Weeks after John's death, Stephen and his partner Janet began appearing at Barbara's door. At first, it seemed like kindness. Bags of groceries, offers of help, quiet companionship for a grieving widow. But kindness, in the wrong hands, can cut deep. They came once a week, then twice. I wanted to believe it was compassion at first, a bridge built over old grudges. Diane didn't. She saw it for what it was, not kindness, but calculation, patient, deliberate. And she was right. By December 2016, Barbara's will was rewritten, completely. What stunned me most was that John's will had mirrored Barbara's original one, both ensuring the estate flowed to Sally's sons. But now, all of that was erased. Every promise made in those long nights of tea and trust, every assurance Irene had died believing, gone. Stephen became sole beneficiary. The grandsons, their only living link to Sally, were left with £20,000 each. A gesture so token, it was almost cruel. And the circumstances surrounding that new will? Alarming. When Barbara sat with the solicitor, she was asked basic questions. Did your sister Irene have any children? Any beneficiaries? Barbara said no. No children. A lie, whether deliberate or confused, I don't know. Irene had grandsons in Norfolk. Then she launched into a story about her past. Told the solicitor she used to live in a house backing onto Greenwich Park, where she'd walk her dogs daily. That wasn't true either. She had lived nowhere near Greenwich Park. We lived backing onto Manor House Gardens. But yes, she and John often visited Greenwich Park with us, walking dogs when they came down. A subtle shift in memory, or a sign of something deeper unraveling. Meanwhile, in the waiting room, the solicitor glanced at Janet, who had driven Barbara there, and assumed she was Barbara's daughter. Barbara didn't correct her. Sally, her real daughter, had been dead since 1998. These were signs. Quiet but glaring, if you knew the truth. Signs that Barbara wasn't of sound mind when she signed that paper, undoing decades of promises and cutting her grandsons out of the inheritance that was meant to secure their future. But you had to know her history to see it, and Stephen knew exactly what he was doing. And that quiet shift, from disapproval to dominion, was no accident. I remember one visit in particular. A business trip had taken me near Goole, and I dropped in to see Barbara after speaking with Andrew Burrows, our till technician who lived nearby. What I found shook me. Her kitchen, once the tidy, humming heart of her home, was now a scene of quiet disarray. Every cupboard had been emptied onto the counters, dishes and containers stacked like a barricade, leaving no space to cook, no surface to breathe. And there, swinging ominously from a broken hinge, was a cabinet door, hanging like a guillotine, poised to fall with the next careless brush of her leg. I fetched my tools from the car. I cleared the clutter. I fixed the door. As we made tea, cup after cup, we slipped into our old rhythm, memories bubbling up between us like a tide trying to reclaim familiar ground. For a moment, it felt like we were replanting something long buried. Comfort, safety, trust. But as I stood there tightening screws, a darker question stirred. Where were Stephen and Janet? Weren't they visiting every week? Weren't they supposedly watching over her? Did they not notice the door, hanging there like a blade over the woman they claimed to care for? Did they walk past the chaos in the kitchen and not think to help? Or did they simply not care? because what I saw wasn't neglect by accident, it was neglect by indifference. And that, perhaps, was even more dangerous. Soon after, I brought my three boys to visit again. Barbara, admitted to a care home after breaking her wrist in a fall, sat shrunken in a pastel cardigan, wrist in a sling, trembling as she raised a teacup. Charlie, her Yorkshire Terrier, was being cared for by a neighbor, and I gently assured her that she'd be back home soon, with her beloved dog by her side once again. In that cold, sterile room, Barbara's eyes, blurred with gratitude, brought back a flicker of warmth that her new routine had quietly erased. I realized then, the broken wrist was not just an injury, it was the fracture of her independence, her routine, her home. I offered to help her move south, but Diane refused. Barbara insisted on remaining in her own house with Charlie and her memories, even that release she wasn't ready to give. In August 2018, we flew to Cyprus for my niece Emil's wedding on the 12th. The island buzzed with celebration. My parents, brother, his wife, their Australian children, everyone except Diane, Caitlin, and Theo. Their absence felt like a spiteful echo. In the midst of vows and dancing, the phone rang. Stephen and his partner had decided Barbara should go back into permanent and care for her own good. A few days later, she fell again, hit her head, and died, alone, undiscovered for hours. Joy turned into silence. And then, in an extraordinary twist, the coroner reached out to me, not Stephen, requesting details of Barbara's health, life, her stories. Because he, the man who inherited everything, knew nothing about her. We decided to dig deeper into Stephen's involvement. And what we uncovered was both chilling and painfully familiar. The new will had been orchestrated under the watchful eye of Stephen and Janet, drafted by Heptonstall's solicitors. There was no medical assessment, no capacity check, no effort to consult Barbara's previous will, the one from 1999 that clearly named her grandsons as the rightful heirs to her estate, the one they had rewrote after the death of her daughter in October 1998. None of it mattered. A solicitor met with Barbara just twice, two brief meetings, arranged by Stephen, facilitated by him, his presence lingering just outside the room. And with a few strokes of a pen, the will was rewritten. The years of promises, the spoken wishes, the moral contract she had so often affirmed, erased. Just like that, everything changed. We enlisted Joanna of Ventura Law. A Lark v. Nugis request went to Heptonstall's, the firm handling Barbara's will. Their reply was damning. Her will had been redrafted days after John's death, arranged by Stephen. No prior wills reviewed, no medical check, nothing written, all verbal. They refused to share more, citing client confidentiality. But what they did admit exposed the erasure of Barbara's life and intentions. No mention of her grandsons, no reconciliation of bizarre claims, no respect for what she had promised. They admitted Stephen and Janet had brought Barbara to the office. She was 90. In their words, pleasant, sweet, independent. She claimed, bizarrely, that she had lived in a house backing onto Greenwich Park. She hadn't. We had, near Manor House Gardens. She had visited, loved it, but never lived there. She told them Sally had died at 50. She was 38. She forgot that Irene had a daughter, Jenny, who died tragically of cancer, leaving two boys. She said her grandchildren seldom called, that she had no contact. That wasn't Barbara speaking. That was Barbara shaped by someone else's voice. The solicitor, John Gill, said he had no doubt whatsoever about her mental capacity. No confusion, he insisted. No memory loss. But the contradictions in his notes said otherwise. Barbara stated multiple times that she wanted Stephen to benefit, not to inherit everything. She said she relied on him. Of course she did. Isolation does that. Narcissistic manipulation does that. You don't have to scream to coerce someone, you just must be there. Every Monday, every errand, every whispered suggestion until the line between gratitude and obedience blurs. She didn't even reread the will before signing. He didn't insist. Her old will was destroyed. It emerged that Stephen had exercised full power of attorney after John's death, granting him control over Barbara's decisions. Was he manipulating her, limiting her independence, redirecting her final wishes? Ben, Remy, and Josh sadly had no fight in them. They didn't know what could be done. They needed a no-win, no-fee solicitor, but Ventura Law had declined that request. Knowing of the injustice and deliberate manipulation by Stephen and Janet, they had no choice but to let it be and hope for karma to do its justice. Because when narcissism hides behind helpfulness, when memory is manipulated, and when silence is mistaken for consent, injustice wins. This was not just the theft of an estate, it was the silencing of a life. Because when no one speaks, the lie becomes history, and silence becomes the final betrayal.